Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, helping product managers become product masters. Listen and get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, your host, and you are listening to the podcast where product managers are becoming product masters. Thanks for joining me and learning about product management and innovation. Also, check out the benefits of becoming a product master by getting the Product Mastery Roadmap. And that's at the same place where you'll find the show notes for this episode, theeverydayinnovator.com/104. My guest today discusses another valuable topic related to the skills that all product managers need, and that, according to one 2016 study, results in a 25% increase in pay. If you want to see the full list of topics that go with that 25% increase in pay, go to theeverydayinnovator.com/podcast and you'll find an index of those. The topic for this episode is how to use storytelling to share ideas and persuade others to join you. My guest is Michael Margolis. He is the CEO and founder of Get Storied that serves leaders, innovators, and trailblazers who have world-changing agendas. He helps those who are inventing the future and need to get their story straight, because ideas don't sell themselves, and we know that as product managers. He's helped Google, NASA, Greenpeace, Deloitte, Facebook, and many others. His work has been featured in Fast Company, Time, and Wired. I hope you enjoy the interview. Michael, thanks so much for joining the Everyday Innovator podcast. I'm glad you can be with us, and we'll explore storytelling a little bit together.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have this conversation with you, Chad. Thanks for inviting me on.
Now, it's been interesting to me, not as much this year. Actually, this podcast, when listeners are listening to it, will be right at the end of 2016. In 2015, this topic of storytelling came up a lot in the context of innovation, and I haven't hit it quite as much this year, and I'm really glad to have the opportunity to talk to you about it. I'm just curious about your background a little bit in terms of how did you end up helping companies in this field of storytelling, right? Because my first impression, now I have a more mature understanding. My first impression of storytelling is like when my young kids, when they were younger, would go to bed and I would tell them stories at night, right? But yeah, That's not quite what we're talking about companies.
Not in the least bit. You know, this is not once upon a time fairy tales or even how to tell a better anecdote, which both are perfectly valid and important things. You know, the work that that I've been doing the last 15 years is really around narrative strategy. It's the process of how you take really anything that's an idea, a product, a service, any kind of business transformation, something really disruptive, and how do you get others to see what you see? How do you convey that idea in a way they can identify with it, that they can relate to it, and they want to be a part of it? It's in many ways the holy grail of what every innovator and human-centered designer is trying to solve for. You know, for years it was things like Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm. But that's becoming, obviously, we're now looking at things in a more complex and nuanced manner as every industry is being disrupted and every organization is going through some kind of transformational change. So I've been obsessed with this question really for more than 15 years, and it came out of my first career as a social entrepreneur. So I graduated from university in the late 1990s, trained as a cultural anthropologist, and I came out into the labor market right at the birth of the internet economy. And very quickly, I found myself at the right place at the right time, and I became a social entrepreneur. So this is basically applying business principles to social change issues. First one was focused on volunteerism, public service. The second one was focused on the digital divide. Both of them had a big technology component to them. And the digital divide is quite literally the growing gap between those who have access to technology and those who don't. And what effect will that have on people's career opportunities, livelihoods, survival, and so on? And I found myself, I had very quick early success. By the age of 23, I was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation. You know, I was advising the U.S. Department of Labor. I was featured in Fast Company magazine and, you know, sort of like that, you know, poster child, young 20 something year old Turk, you know, before folks like Mark Zuckerberg were a household mm-hmm. name, the idea of being a 20 year old, you know, doing this stuff was kind of the first wave of it.
Yeah. Take it on the world.
Right. And by the age of 24, epic startup fail.
Oh,
it all fell apart. And, you know, I ate a lot of shit pies in the process. And to be honest with you, that's when my journey with storytelling really began. It was picking up the pieces from, you know, the physical, emotional, mental, spiritual breakdown of that so many of us go on as entrepreneurs or change agents, and feeling like something had been missing from the conversation. Like I intuitively knew it. There was something missing, but I didn't have the language for it. And I started looking around, like, where could I learn this language? Because when you deal with innovation, you know, I mean, product innovation is one thing. Service innovation is another thing. Mm-hmm. But social innovation, boy, you want to talk about taking on a complex stack. You know, I was working with the Digital Divide on issues of poverty, of race relations, of like every taboo, bugaboo issue, you know, that's part of like civil society. And we don't really have a vocabulary or language for it. And was trying to reframe the story, was trying to change the way people thought about and related to those issues. And I realized that it all came down to the story. And not just for social innovation, but any of us who are innovators, we're ultimately trying to bring forward a new story, and we're often up against what is an old story. And it's when those two come together that a whole nother story unfolds. And that's the, you know, the long, hard road that so many of us are on with trying to bring forward our product innovations.
Yeah, a couple of things that tie well there to product managers and innovators, the old story versus the new story, right? We're always talking about change when we're talking about innovation because we're doing something new. There's always a new part of this. And the your epic failure, man, I love failure stories when people learn from them and move forward, right? And my favorite Japanese proverb is, you know, fall down seven times, get up eight. It's this notion of, you know, falling down is just part of the learning process, and it's really healthy for us, actually, as long as we're getting up and moving on. And as innovators, product managers, depending which stats you believe, I've seen credible numbers anywhere from, let's say, about 1 in 20 product attempts are a success, up to a much better percentage of about 4 in 10, and then really good organizations that are doing about 1 in 2. But that means that we are failing along the way as we're learning. And we should expect that we're doing something new, right? If we're doing something new, we're not going to get it right the first time.
Yeah, well, and I think the thing that I've particularly been very passionate about is the internal story that's part of that equation. So obviously, when you have a product innovation, you ultimately need to, you know, communicate that externally in the marketplace to customers, and there's some type of a disruption or a shift in perceptions that happens there. I'm far more interested personally in the internal change adoption process. What does it take to get your own team aligned around the same core story, much less all of the other stakeholder groups you're working with internally for the journey that the life cycle that, you know, it takes for an idea to ultimately run through the organization, go to market, and successfully be deployed in the marketplace?
Yeah, and that's what I really want to dive into. It's this notion of doing something new inside the organization is immediately going to be met with resistance. It's something we just love to do, is to say why ideas aren't going to work. And my perception from talking with others and using storytelling some myself is storytelling is actually how we can start building a coalition, how we can start kind of sharing a vision and getting people to move along with us instead of just being all the doubting Thomases.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, you know, I mentioned, you know, my training and background as a cultural anthropologist, and you know, a lot of people back when I started studying that were you know, sort of WTF, what the heck are you going to do with that? You know, and thankfully through the world of design thinking and corporate ethnography, and a lot of product innovators really have come to see the great power of that. You know, I think in many ways I became an anthropologist because I used to suck at storytelling and I was afraid of people. So what do? You, right? You take the thing you're most afraid of and you want to study it, you know, in order to kind of better understand it. But I think one of the things that's important for us to remember when it comes to dealing with change inside our organizations and that resistance that we come up against, it's actually the culture doing exactly what it's programmed to do. We often forget this. People love to say, you know, the culture is broken. Or, you know, the culture's too, you know, has lost its way. Well, we forget that we owe our life to that culture. Like that culture and how it, you know, because culture is designed for self-preservation. Mm-hmm. It's programmed for safety and survival. And so this, you know, the reason I mention this is because this is, I think, one of the most important threads to pull on. When we introduce a new story, what we have to pay attention to is what are the ways to architecture that new story to fit within the ecosystem of the old story or the existing culture. You have to lattice it in. Mm-hmm. If you present a story that's in direct opposition to the old story or the existing story, it will chew you up and spit you right out. Those are, you know, the antibodies within the culture. And so that's part of the art of this, is to help connect, that, you know, because when you present the new story, it's really easy to feel like the new story is somehow a repudiation of the old story, mm-hmm. that you're saying that the old story is not good enough anymore. Right. So this is part of what we have to unpack. And, you know, we do a lot of work inside, some of Silicon Valley's biggest companies, and especially a lot of work also then in financial services and healthcare, you know, in high growth startups. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what sector we're working in, we're dealing with that same fundamental issue of how to get the story straight and how to get people to locate themselves in the story as context in the world keeps changing.
And I just wanted to highlight, since you mentioned it again, your degree in culture anthropology, it was actually something that caught my attention when I was looking at your bio, because ethnography is my favorite research tool, right? When it comes to getting insights into customers' problems, I don't know of a better way than using ethnography to accomplish that. And as a culture anthropologist, I thought, wow, this is a person who is good at diving into those sort of environments to get insights.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot for us to gain from an anthropological lens. Mm-hmm. When you think about the fact that the most basic unit of creation is story, right? And if you want to learn about and with every product, there's a story, right? And we have to remember that people don't buy the product; they buy the story that's attached to it. Mm-hmm. Right. Of what's the thing this thing means to people? And interestingly enough, you know, stories also give us a pathway into the culture. Because if you want to learn about a culture, you want to listen to the stories. And if you want to change a culture, you change the stories. So there's, you know, for those of us who are interested in basically hacking the culture, you want to get into the DNA source code for how new ideas take hold. It's one of the ways to do this is by learning the language of narrative. Mm-hmm. So this is a big part of our mission at Get Storied. You know, our mission is to teach the world how to think in narrative. That's why this is not about how to tell a better anecdote. This is not once upon a time fairy tales. It's actually the principles and practices of narrative. How do you apply that strategically to the process of innovation and change? You know, as a leader, we're literally inventing new futures. We're creating new possibilities. We're improving the human experience in ways we never imagined before. And there's a great responsibility that comes with that and a great humility of all the different ways I can go off the rails because we're talking about the human experience.
And that's exactly what I want to dive into some specifics with you on. Is inside the organization, as these product managers and innovators, the everyday innovators listening, how is it indeed we use storytelling to help get those ideas connected to what's going on in the organization, conveyed in such a way that those antibodies don't immediately attack it and destroy what we're trying to accomplish? So where do we start? I don't know if there's a step-by-step process to this, but
sure.
where do we start?
Yeah, well, definitely. Let's unpack one of our signature methodologies, which we call undeniable story. Okay. Now, but before I get into a few of those steps, let's just set some sort of set the table of what are some of the use cases for this, right? So the use cases for this actually are pretty robust. First of all, how many of us, need to present a strategic vision to our team or to, in a town hall, a wider set of audiences where they understand the larger vision and roadmap for a product or, for a business unit's direction. Mm-hmm. So that's one use case. Another use case is the quarterly business review. You're in front of your boss or director, or their boss's boss, and you need to talk about the progress that you're making on your product and, on this product deployment and where you are in that innovation cycle. You might also have a lot of money or budget that's tied to your ability to effectively convey not only the possibilities of what this thing is can offer, how you're managing or mitigating risk, and then the progress that you're making towards, however you're keeping score, whatever those key, KPIs or key metrics are of how your company, is going to measure success. Another one is oftentimes, once you've got the product that's designed, you then hand things over to the marketing team, or you might be working with the marketing team. And, have any of us ever seen a creative brief that sucked, that really didn't give you much to work with? It's got all the basics, here's our audience and here's our strategy and our tactics and here's the demographics, but it really doesn't give you a way to get into the soul of what's this thing really about? So this methodology, Undeniable Story, can be used also as a blueprint for that, as a way to basically have a brief that will inspire your outside agency and all of the other, teams that are part of rolling out a global marketing campaign. And then lastly, the question also comes up in any team is, how coherent is the story across the team? Hmm. If you actually pulled all of your different team members aside and say, okay, well, hey, what's the story of this product? And it's kind of like that old, great parable about the elephant. One person says it's got fluffy ears. The other person describes the tail. Somebody else, says it shits peanuts. But it's like, we all see a different piece of the elephant. So creating that sense of coherence and alignment that we're all telling the same core story is another use case in place where, time and time again, this is an issue that shows up in every organization, that imaginable. So with all that said, how do you actually approach this stuff? And I'll share with your community the foundational steps to our Undeniable Story framework. And it's built on the following principle. Okay, the following principle is you have to see it and you have to feel it in order to believe it. And this is a really important principle as it relates to idea adoption. Because most of us, we've all been taught in business, right? Lead with the data. Mm-hmm. But if you start your story with the data, the story is dead on arrival. Because, one, we don't have any context, and we don't really have any emotional relationship to that story, of which then this data supports. And let's be honest, we all know that you can dig up data to support anything. Mm-hmm. I can too. So this is the paradox of where we find ourselves in, where we're often sitting down with people leading with data that they don't believe or they don't care about or they don't know how to contextualize. And so you might get people nodding their heads, but they're not really on board. They're not leaning in. They're not accepting your story as their story. So this is really what we teach in Undeniable Story. So if you need to see it and feel it to believe it, well, what corresponds to that for us are three actual steps, which is context, emotion, and evidence.
Okay.
Right? So context is the following principle, which is, when you start a story, a lot of people say, you know, and Simon Sinek's got this great framework and piece of thought leadership, you know, called Start With Why. Mm-hmm. And the why is so important. I'm all about the why. And at the same time, I actually would argue we need to start with where.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is, where am I? You see, when you start a story, what your audience is trying to figure out is, where the heck are we? Like, what world are you asking me to step into? Mm-hmm. What's that ecosystem? What's that universe? What's the context? Paint that picture for me. Is this a world I relate to that matters to me? Right? And if very quickly capture people's imagination, if you can't get them curious and leaning in, well, you're going to have a really hard time carrying that attention through the rest of your presentation. Mm-hmm. So that's the first principle, is context. Then the second principle, emotion, this is where, we actually now need to show, and get people to feel how much you care about, who's at the heart of this story. And who's at the heart of the story is usually either a customer, or a really key internal stakeholder. But you're telling the story in a way that really shows that you really get what they're going through, where you're showing the emotional impact this has on people's lives. And then lastly, the third step we call evidence. This is where you bring in the data, where you demonstrate that you have a right to tell us this story, that this story is real. Here's the proof. So these steps stack on top of each other. This is the shorthand version of our undeniable story methodology we do in three steps. This is what we teach in our one-day masterclass. But we also have then a two-day version where we actually go into six steps, which is but they're still built on these same three fundamental principles.
And I want to unpack the context, emotion, and evidence a little bit. Yeah. And I'm wondering if you have an example that you could walk us through that would help kind of illustrate how these are applied.
Yeah, absolutely. Right now we're working with one of Silicon Valley's largest companies, and they have a massive campus in Silicon Valley where 20,000 plus employees are on that campus every day. Mm-hmm. And these guys need to, they're going to be spending several billion dollars over the next 5 years to create the campus of the future, to evolve and adapt that campus.
This sounds like a fruity sort of company, like, not an orange, but maybe an apple.
It's not apple, but it certainly could, right?
Okay. So I was going to say, I got to be close. So there's only a couple to choose from.
Yeah. So, but here's the thing. I mean, this is true for all big companies. And so here we've got the head, the VP of this business unit who's charged with this transformation. In many ways, they're first and foremost in the real estate business, but what they're doing has implications on employee experience, employee engagement. Mm-hmm. So it's an HR issue. It's a culture issue. We're dealing with issues of housing and transportation in the area. We're dealing with issues of actual workplace innovation. What's the right workspaces for different types of work that's happening? And then you actually have literally the real estate management, real estate investment side of this. So very complex stack, along with very complex set of stakeholders, including this company is part of a larger global company. So there's those politics as well. Hmm. So with all of that in mind, here's the context, right? Which is, everybody wants the dream house, but nobody wants to live in the house while it's being renovated.
It's messy to live in the house while it's being renovated.
So, now the balance to it is, so that's part of the context. That's part of the setup. And the reality is, here we are, we're making a commitment of several billion dollars to continue to make this one of the best places to work. All right. So there's a degree of investment. It's like, we really care. We're committed to this. And, you know, and obviously there's a lot of then specific initiatives that they're doing across the campus. But this is the context that we're setting up for people, right? So all these great things that are coming, but it also is going to come with some pain and some disruption. Now the, you know, the emotional side to this is being able to speak to some of the actual real friction that employees experience every single day. So if you work in Silicon Valley, one of the biggest stress points are issues of your daily commute mm-hmm. and the cost of housing. And so, and you know, and frankly, if you want more house for your money, what are you going to do? You're going to live a little further away from Silicon Valley, all right? Maybe out in the East Bay, maybe you go out to Walnut Creek or something, but guess what? Then you got even more commute.
That amplifies the other problem.
Okay. So these are some of the issues, but part of what our client has done is learn, you know, through our work together, they've learned to speak to that friction or pain, to talk about it. And then, you know, a lot of people on the campus, they're upset that they've made changes in the parking lot structures. And now people have to sometimes walk 5, 10, or 15 extra minutes to get to their office because, you know, they've added, you know, thousands of new parking spots, but they're further away. They're less convenient. So, you know, this head of this business unit had to tell the story of, well, look, you know, what we've recently done is in the center of campus, we've put in all of these new amenities, you know, this incredible employee center and all of these things that are about improving the employee experience. Because we had to make a choice. Would we rather have this employee center in the center of campus, or would we rather have a parking lot in the center of campus? We can't have both. So part of this, when you're dealing with the emotional content in the story, is you want to validate your audience's experience. In this case, you know, our client is really telling an employee story. That's their audience here. And being able to empathize, like, I feel your pain. Mm-hmm. I get what you're going through. And I want you to understand that we're really committed. We're really thinking about how to make life better for you. Right. And then the last piece, evidence, this is where then one, excuse me, one presents a lot of the data on all of the incredible investments and changes that are happening on the campus and the amazing feedback that they're getting from people as they're putting in this whole next generation way of doing work, you know, with, you know, sort of better socio-technology, with more collaborative workspaces, with better employee, you know, experience benefits, things like that.
Mm-hmm. I was making a connection in my head as you were going through this, and I was working with a customer some time ago that needed to improve their innovation process, a good size organization. And I'm learning as you're going through this that we could have done a much better job in presenting the findings of our mm-hmm. work to their executive team, because they made a conclusion that was not optimal, right? And not at all aligned with what our recommendations were. But it was, looking at it, you know, in retrospect, it was a conclusion that was very consistent with their culture, right? Mm. So it's one of these stories, you know, where you say, company spends all this money on a study, and then they go ahead and do what they were going to do in the first place anyhow, right? It doesn't particularly matter. But they did come to a conclusion that was consistent. And if we would have made some good connections with the existing culture, recognizing what was going on now, and if they continue on that path, what the future would look like, which was what was really, you know, worrisome for everyone, versus if they were to depart from that path and create a new path. And I don't think we made good connections recognizing what their big issues were today and trying to acknowledge the culture and how we could connect to that and yet move away from it, you know, in a way.
Yeah, very. It's very true. I mean, look, we're right now in the midst of a project with another big tech company that you know is one of the biggest, you know, social media companies in the world, and you know, we're working with a product team. So we're working with a mm-hmm. product director and their counterpart head of design. These guys came on a year ago to take over this product, really take it to the next level. You know, because they're one of the biggest social media companies in the world, they've got, you know, a user base that makes most of us just our jaw drop when you think about the implications of scale. Mm-hmm. But it's a product within this company's ecosystem of products that has been maybe a little below the radar or doesn't get the full value, that isn't appreciated for its full value and implications. So they came to us with, look, we've done all this great research. We've got a better insight on things. We've got a clear roadmap for this coming year and how we're going to update the product and all these different enhancements, you know, and now, you know, we need to communicate and sell that vision and roadmap throughout the organization, you know, to our chief product officer and ultimately the CEO of the company. Mm-hmm. You know, so help us tell that bigger story. And, you know, a lot of that was about helping to contextualize how our sense of identity, how our sense of relationships keeps evolving in the digital age, how our sense of belonging is changing. And what role does this product as part of this social media platform have in that process? You know, and ultimately, you know, and of course, the evidence we have and so on and the emotional content around this is supreme, you know, but that's what we had to kind of reframe it of like, do you see this underlying transformation going on in the culture? That's the context. And then the emotional content was then showing lots of examples of this. You know, let me tell you a story about how people are using this in Istanbul. Let me tell you a story about this 17-year-old girl and how she's using it to deal with a health issue in her life. You know, let me tell you about this 45-year-old new mother, you know, and how she's using it to address kind of this whole change in her life. Like, so we started to like give all in a way like user stories
right.
that brought it to life. And then we close it out with the evidence, which is here's the roadmap. Mm-hmm. And also here's the evidence we have on how our product fits within the larger ecosystem, that we can be an engine of growth for many other product teams within the company.
I'm wondering if you find yourself getting involved with scenario planning in the sense of, in the innovation context, when we think of scenario planning, we're often looking at further out timelines, right? Like saying, okay, based on trends that we're starting to see emerge, like the current one is, you know, moving to electric vehicles. Yep. In 10, 20, 30 years, what impact is this going to have on our part of the world, right? Our influence in the world.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you, as you go through the context and emotion and evidence, if you find yourself looking at cases like, and this is where things are going in our industry. In 10 years, if we don't take this action now, this is how what we expect things to look like. Do you go through a scenario like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, this is part of the innovator's dilemma. You know, or a different not Clay Christensen's version, but right. but this the dilemma of the following, which is we got to remember that as innovators, we are in the business of speculation. Hmm. We are we're putting a bet on a potential or probable outcome. So the question that we have to answer is how do we bring integrity to the process of speculation? This is what we have to figure out as an innovator, as a change agent. And when you're presenting your pitch, you know, to other stakeholders or to your own team, you have to tell that story about a possible future.
Right.
Knowing that it, you know, no story is ever a straight line and best laid plans are going to come undone. So how do you sell people on that future, knowing it's a moving target? And if you overpromise or present it in the wrong way as a foregone conclusion, you're at risk of jeopardizing your credibility, your believability and trust that you need to maintain healthy working relationships mm-hmm. with that audience over time.
Yeah. You don't want to be the person who is perceived as running around saying the sky is falling.
Yeah. Or the person who's, you know, promising 20% year over year, you know, returns on something that's highly speculative, right. with a really big risk exposure threshold. And sort of perceived as a loose cannon or as someone who, you know, we got to remember that this storytelling stuff is not just about selling a story. At the end of the day, as a product innovator, you have to deliver on that story. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the creative tension. And this is why in our approach, part of what we do with that is telling a good story related to innovation is far more about being able to frame good questions than it is about being able to frame and present all the answers. Because if you give people all of the answers, guess what? The story's over.
Right.
You just told me you figured it out. Right? Like the moment you give people all of the answers, the end, you wrapped it up in a pretty little bow. We might as well go home. And yeah. You've got all the answers. What do you need me for? I mean, you told me about this problem, right? Like you talked about the problem, which guess what? I can't help but take personally because this problem happened on my watch. I'm complicit for that problem. So I'm going to get a little defensive. We're talking about a problem, not a simple problem, but a big problem. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about it, so I don't feel very good about this. I'm uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. You're making me feel like crap. All right, I'm going to push back on you. Oh, but wait, you have the answer. All right, well, fine. Why don't you do it?
Right.
I mean, how many times have we had that conversation with our spouse or significant other? You know, when we go home, you know, over some squabble that's going on, right? Mm-hmm. So we know this in our intimate relationships, like somebody who says, okay, there's a problem, a big problem. Chad, I got an issue I need to tell you about. All right, you're naturally going to get defensive, collapse, your energy kind of goes down, you know, and then after being, you know, this being described and you feeling like you're being berated, then this person tells you they have the answer. Well, you know, our natural reaction is, okay, great, why don't you do it?
Right.
What do you need me for?
You're certainly not building coalitions at that point. You're not pulling people along with you. You're not accomplishing any of the things that you want to do to get momentum going for your idea. You just shut it down.
Yeah.
And I'm starting to appreciate more back when you talked about context, starting with the where instead of the why, and that the where you're really kind of painting a picture to draw people in that immediately lets them self-identify. Do I want to be part of this picture or not? Do I want to see myself in that scenario?
Do I belong in this story?
Because if you start with the why can be kind of abrasive.
It can. Like, it can be preachy.
Yeah.
It can be judgmental. It can be like, yeah, it can. Oh, you're telling me that I don't care about something that, you know, like, oh, I don't, that somehow I'm not, you know, like it can feel self-righteous, you know, like, oh, well, yeah, you're apparently more enlightened than we are. You know, you're talking about this thing and you're saying that our products right now aren't sustainable enough, or that our products, you know, aren't thinking about the customer enough, or, you know, like that's the challenge with leading with the problem, which is completely right. Counterintuitive to what we've all been taught, you know, problem solution. And by the way, to any of you who are listening, who are freaking out right now, when I say problem solution, you know, like throw it out the window. I'm not saying throw it out the window. Problem solution is great as an engineer. Problem solution's fantastic from a research insights perspective. Mm-hmm. All I'm saying is problem solution makes for a crappy story.
Exactly.
So when it comes to then communicating your product breakthrough, you want to flip the polarity around. So problem solution is minus plus, right? You're starting with what's wrong. Mm-hmm. And then you're saying, well, don't worry though, here's the good news. Instead, you flip it around. We call it possibility obstacle.
Okay.
So in many ways, we can link this right back to context, Chad, which is, you know, what's changed in the last 5 years that makes this possible in a way we never could have dreamed or done before? Right? What new possibilities, what new opportunities do we have in our industry or in our category that creates the opening for this product innovation? That's how you open the door. Here's this possibility.
Right.
How exciting is this? That this convergence of forces because of technology and economics and cultural forces, we can do this now. Mm-hmm. And then though, but you know, here's the obstacles. There's still creative tension. right? Which might be issues of culture change and adoption, which might be how we educate the marketplace and a really complex, process of buying decisions, or the obstacle might be from a market share perspective, or being a disruptive technology, and how do we educate people about this new way of doing it? There's always going to be big obstacles, but you have to put forward and establish, get people open and receptive to, wow, this is possible. Wow, you're right. We can do this now. Before, we couldn't have in this at the same level, at the same scale, or at the same cost. That's how you win the room to then want to go on the journey with you to explore how do we address these obstacles.
And that indeed is the objective when we're trying to build the story to share ideas, is winning the room. I like how you presented that as the possibility obstacle matrix, right? My background is engineering. That's what I'm trained as. I know I've gotten myself in trouble too many times because I think as an engineer, which is, let's identify the problems and then we look for the solutions. And you lose people along the way. You don't build momentum. That's an inherent challenge for me. I haven't broken that tendency yet, but I know at least enough now to find someone who's really good at doing the possible obstacle kind of approach. I generically refer to that person as the cheerleader, right? Probably not the best characterization, but yep. I always need a cheerleader with me that can help get the story started.
Yeah, that's a great way to approach it. In the this process of getting the story straight. It's what we do, possibility obstacle. We call it the rule of paradox. So we often, we're so hell bent in business. Well, we think we're supposed to tell a story that has certainty, that everything's figured out.
Right.
Right. But actually, what makes a story interesting is creative tension. There's got to be some type of opposing forces. And we need to, because if you have a story that's just, high note, aren't we great? We're the best. We've got this all covered. There's no story. Right. So the rule of paradox is you actually need to find the creative tension and name it and actually make friends with it. Like we're working with a company that is a tech company that's in the customer support category. And, and obviously that whole category these days is all about AI, in being able to deploy AI. And one of the big challenges with AI is the challenge between, how do we scale automation and at the same time not lose the human touch or the human experience, right? So that's the trade-off. And customer support, VPs, what they're struggling with is these incredible high volumes of tickets. And the more we automate, well, the more diminishing that sense of personalized, empathic, contextual experience is going to be. We got to name it. And then, thankfully this company has an incredible solution that addresses just that. And a really unique model for how they crack the code on sort of self-learning machines, and how do we transfer the thing that is irreplaceable that right now only humans have, which in many ways is the storytelling gene. It's the ability to contextualize, to empathize.
Good. And we could keep on because this is really fascinating to me too. But let me just review framework here real quick. So the core part of the undeniable story is the context, the emotion, and the evidence. Those are our three big pieces.
Yep. You got to see it. And you got to feel it in order to believe it.
Good. And building this place of where people might want to come and join you to start the story with them. How can people find out more about this, more about the work that you're doing? What resources do you have available?
Yeah, absolutely. We have tons. So our mission at Get Storied is to teach the world how to think in narrative. So if you are a corporate innovator, if you are a global change maker, visit us at getstoried.com. Mm-hmm. If you go to getstoried.com/undeniable story, you can actually take the online course version of the methodology that we just described. If you want to actually just sort of get more of a taste around our work, you can go to getstoried.com/world-changing, and we have a free 10-part video series, although that has far more of a around social innovation. So if you're open to taking some of those lessons and how those might then translate to your change-making initiatives, you can check that out. It's a great video series. And then I welcome hearing from people. We do a lot of lot of work as trusted advisors for senior leaders that have innovation and change initiatives that they want to get their story straight.
Good. And what's a good way to get in touch with you? Is there a contact form on Get Storied? Or
yeah, there is. But feel free to email me. My email is Michael M. So Michael and my last name initial M. And it's at getstoried.com. So you can email me directly. I also spend a lot of time on Twitter. I've got 250,000 followers there. And if you're interested in sort of exploring more of this philosophy of a storied approach to how to drive innovation and change, we share a ton of resources that way. And you'll find a lot of our articles through that path. Or equally, you can find them on our website or on LinkedIn.
Okay. And what's your Twitter handle?
At Get Storied.
Very good. And as listeners know, I always like to ask for an innovation quote. Do you have one that you brought, and can you share why you chose that one?
Yeah, you know, so I didn't bring one in advance, but I have one for you, which is actually, especially since we're dealing with, you know, a community of product innovators, which is Peter Drucker's definition of entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard this before?
If it talks about the two functions of business, it's my most favorite one, but I want you you should share it.
Yeah, it's exactly that. So Peter Drucker, I think, has the most distilled essential definition of entrepreneurship, or the two functions of business, which he says are innovation mm-hmm. plus marketing, mm-hmm. right? Those are the two fundamental functions. So obviously, innovation oftentimes is what, you know, as product folks, what we're focused on. It's building the better mousetrap. It's solving the problem or the challenge. And then marketing is getting others to care about it.
Right.
And in both cases, while it's the process of the innovation, change, adoption internally, or getting others to care about it, it all comes down to storytelling.
It ties in. And storytelling is an important thing for product managers and innovators to gain some competencies in. And if you're like me and you're still having trouble with those competencies, find someone you can team up with. And I appreciate you sharing the resources tools too, so we can learn more about this. And we should go check it out at getstory.com. Michael, thanks for your time.
It's been awesome, Chad. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Most, if not all of us, can improve our skills persuading and influencing others. And Michael shared a valuable framework in his three principles of context, emotion, and evidence. If you don't already have my Product Mastery Roadmap that shows how you can increase your influence, your success, and the success of your products, please download it now. You'll find a link to it from the same place the summary and transcript of the discussion with Michael is. Just go to theeverydayinnovator.com/104. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to The Everyday Innovator, which teaches product managers to become product masters. For more resources, please visit our blog at theeverydayinnovator.com.